You're about to hear my conversation with Darren McKiernan. We talk all about how he approaches portfolio construction, how he views companies that make it into his portfolio, as well as how he thinks about companies and their capital allocation decisions. I hope you enjoy. This podcast is for informational purposes only. Information relating to investment approaches or individual investments should not be construed as advice or endorsement. Listeners should seek professional advice for their situation. Welcome to The Invested, a podcast from Mackenzie Investments. My name is Matthew Schnurr, and I'm delighted to be here with Darren McKiernan. Darren leads our global dividend strategy. Darren, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Matt. Good to be back.
I thought we'd start things off. I know that we've talked about it in previous podcasts, but it's always good to get a reminder. Why don't we start off by the types of businesses that you look for when you're thinking about constructing your portfolio or creating the dream team that we'll talk about later on?
Sure. I guess maybe I'll start off by saying, it's really more important to us. It's what we don't look at, right? We pass on a lot more stuff that comes by our desk than we actually investigate. You think about it, and I've talked about this before, there are literally thousands of companies out there that we could, in theory, invest in, right? They have a certain minimum market cap or liquidity, and so they're technically fair game. But really, we choose not to. And a lot of that is because, really, the biggest reason, the only reason, I would say, is that they don't have any real discernible competitive advantage, right? Mm. Or we call it a moat. Buffett calls it a moat. I mean, you can. There's different way monikers that are used, but it's really just it's something that allows a company to flourish over long periods of time. Now, what do we mean? Like, you can always find stuff that is might have an advantage. We think, right now, like you think about going into the pandemic, right? And, Zoom, right?
Sure.
It was something that, all of a sudden people all of a sudden discovered, remote working from home and the importance of remote video access and being able to have meetings and have conversations. And, I know from our standpoint, it was critical, right?
Right.
But we just couldn't get my head around the fact that, there's Teams, there's Zoom, there's all sorts of different options. WebEx was another one. And I just couldn't say, that's great that it's going now. And like you could almost guess that what the numbers were going to look like coming, for that stretch of period. But we're like, what is this going to look like? And forget 10 years from now, 3 years from now, right? So it's really that question of sustainability. And now why is that important, right? I mean, ultimately having a moat or a competitive advantage drives ongoing and high return on invested capital. It helps create sustainable free cash flow. And ultimately, that's what gives us confidence in a company's terminal value, which is like really the most critical aspect of valuing any business.
Right.
And it's all those high returns and free cash flows that ultimately, what drives what we think a company is worth. Okay. And ultimately drives shareholder returns. And so maybe getting into a little more specifics, the next obvious question would be, if I'm interpreting your question right, Matt, it's what are we looking for? What moats or what competitive advantages are we looking for?
Sure, yeah.
And this is what allows us. People say, oh my gosh, you've got this huge global, call it set of companies. How do you delineate from the thousands of companies you could own, to what you have? Well, it really comes down to, it's pretty straightforward. We've boiled it down to what we consider to be six competitive advantages or moats. And every company we own has to have some sort of like one of those six. And again, it's not something we don't necessarily have to own it today, but to get on our dream team, it has to have one of those competitive advantages. And we've boiled it down to these six things: network economics, privileged assets, high switching costs, intellectual property, psychological imperatives, which is kind of a cheeky way of saying brands, and regulatory barriers. And again, every company we look at, every company that comes across our desk or into our inbox or that we meet has to have one of those, which again allows it to create those sustainable free cash flows over the long term and gives us confidence in that terminal value going, whether it's 10 years from now, 15 years from now, and ideally 20 years from now. And so really that's it. And once we found that, again, it just becomes a matter of, okay, what price do we want to pay here? And that's, I would say, the easiest part of our job, but it certainly is less complicated than thinking about what a business might look like in 5 or 10 or 15 years.
Great context. I love the six different buckets that you put the different companies in, and clearly sort of companies with the attributes that fall into one of those six. You mentioned high return on investment capital, high free cash flow. I'm curious, how much do you care or how do you think about what the companies do with all the cash that they're generating? You know, they can buy another firm, they can do merger and acquisition, they can return capital to shareholders through dividends or share buybacks, or they can invest in their own business. How do you evaluate that?
Well, okay. Well, first of all, you mentioned all the things that kind of we consider, and they're all important, right? But depending on what stage of life a company's at will depend on what we want to emphasize. Now, look, we run our flagship, the Global Dividend Fund, right? Dividends are an important component, okay, obviously.
Sure.
Historically, they've been actually, if you go back many, many years, decades, dividends have accounted for something like over 15% of reinvested dividends have accounted for something like 15% of total shareholder returns. Now, that's been a lot lower over the last 10 years, given sort of it's been more of a growth-oriented market. Dividend yield has been less important. You know, in a market that's going up double digits, nobody really cares that you're getting a 2% dividend yield.
Right.
And our flexibility in terms of our own thinking about how we put the portfolio together has allowed the company and allowed the fund, even though it's a dividend fund, to do reasonably well in what's been, I'll call it a less than ideal environment for dividend stocks. But that being said, to get to your original question, you know, dividends are an important component, but depending on the company and depending on where the company is at, it will depend on what we emphasize. So, using a company like Coca-Cola, right, which is one of those dividend aristocrats, it's been paying a growing dividend for going on 50 years.
Sure.
You know, it pays out something like 2/3 of its earnings get paid out in the form of dividends, almost 70% of its earnings, right? Now, you think, why is that? Well, because you think about Coca-Cola and you think about, you know, how, call it, mature the company is. Like, there's not too many places in the world. You could probably go to sub-Saharan Africa and find, you know, Coca-Cola somewhere, right, in terms of being. So it's not like it's got a whole lot of, you know, areas in the world where it's not ubiquitous or at least offered. Now, that doesn't mean it can't grow. It will continue to grow, we think, in excess of GDP. It's a highly, like in terms of its capital required, very, very little capital is required. And again, it'll grow reasonably okay with population growth, a little bit of, you know, GDP plus, but it's certainly the days of the heady, you know, 10-15% top line growth is no longer certainly past it. But it's still a very good business, and still I think that, again, the brands that it owns are still, I think, quite valuable, and it shows in terms of the returns. Dividends are an important part of that company. A company like Amazon, which does not pay a dividend, you know, is a good example of where, look, I don't necessarily want Amazon to be paying a dividend. Now, I think that's going to change over time here.
Sure.
And you're seeing it now. Meta just recently announced, again, this is one of the big Mag 7 sort of non-dividend paying companies, announced a dividend. But again, it's a small one. And I don't want companies like that still have a huge amount of top line growth and addressable markets to sort of mine, to be returning capital in the form of dividends. Okay, I'd rather them spend it on CapEx. I'd rather them spend it on, you know, even expanding via M&A. So that's a good example of where, you know, they're in different parts of their timeline. You know, but I would say there's some companies, I think, that do a better job of it than others in terms of, you know, talking about capital allocation. One of our, favorite companies and that we've owned for a long time that seems to have figured it out, like just an amazing balance between dividends, buybacks, and M&A is a company called Broadcom. This is a company we've owned for a number of years, like probably going on 6-7 years now. It's gotten a lot of attention recently because it's one of those, call it the artificial intelligence AI beneficiaries. It's got some of the best semiconductor franchises in the world. I mean, everyone, of course, NVIDIA is the sort of the poster child for this AI revolution. But I would say that Broadcom's right behind NVIDIA in terms of the attractiveness of its semiconductor franchise in terms of leveraging that. But this is a company that, for years, has paid out 50% of its earnings in the form of dividends, right? It's been an incredible M&A machine, okay? The CEO, Hock Tan, has got, I think he's one of the best capital allocators in not just tech, but all of, call it all Fortune 1000. They had the strategy of buying what was perceived to be of slower growth, infrastructure software management companies that people had kind of left for not for dead, but certainly like, okay, they weren't growing a lot. They were like companies like CA Associates, like Symantec, that had this, you know, great client base that they were kind of living off of, but there wasn't a lot of growth. Well, Hawk kind of turned that on the head, on its head, and said, look, it's not because these companies weren't growing. They just weren't managed as optimally as we can. And so what they did is they took an M&A strategy that bought these what were perceived to be low growth businesses and really, really tuned them up into really actually very attractive growth software assets. The other part of the business, again, is semiconductors, where, I mean, they have, you know, market leading franchises across ASICs, across Ethernet connections. It's a really, you know, there's not something like 99% of all internet traffic touches some of their products, and all those data centers that are running on NVIDIA chips, they don't function without Broadcom's products either. So they're almost like a poster child for doing it right, because they still generate tons of free cash. They're going to generate like $30 billion in free cash in the next year or two. They still feel that they can grow more than adequately in double digits, but still pay out a 50% dividend payout ratio. And so they're a really, I think, almost like, I would say, nobody's perfect, but they do a really good job. They realize that they can still continue to grow tremendously well. They can allocate capital through M&A. They buy back a ton of stock. I mean, it's a company that's got higher operating margins than Microsoft, and still pay out a huge dividend. And so, you know, to answer your original question, it depends on where the company is on its journey. Some companies do better than others.
Right.
Obviously something that we talk to every company about in terms of their, you know, their priorities and what makes sense. But when we're looking at a company, we're even though we run a dividend fund and dividends are important, we're not naive to the fact that some companies are better served doing different things with their capital than just paying a dividend.
Great context, Aaron. I'm curious on your portfolio construction, and let me expand on it a little bit. I think when most people think about portfolio construction, they immediately gravitate to what's your sector positioning, what are your countries that you're allocating to. You've just mentioned in this conversation the six different advantages or moats that these companies may have, different ideas on capital allocation and what companies should be doing with the money that they produce. How do you think about that in portfolio construction? Are you trying to get a combination of all of those different types of businesses? Are you more focused on country sectors, or how does that go into the meat grinder, I guess, in order to create the portfolio?
Yeah, really, actually, good question, Matt. I haven't heard that one for a while. You know, first of all, I want to mention that and make sure that everyone understands, you know, every company we own is in there for a fundamental reason, right? Everyone, again, has some sort of competitive advantage. Now, ideally, you know, a company has more than one, but it's rare. We have four stock exchanges, right, or financial exchanges, because we think that they have, like, they benefit from network effects, they benefit from really high switching costs, and of course there are huge regulatory barriers to being a regional stock exchange. So, and I'd also comment that, you know, I don't think not every moat is considered equal, is built equally. I think, like, network economics are amongst the most, you know, toughest and best competitive advantage to have. Whereas brands, I mean, the importance of brands, it's still important, but it's a lot easier to create a brand and a competing brand in consumer products today than it was certainly 15, 20 years ago. So we think about it that way too as well. So start from the fundamental premise that every company's in there for a reason and a qualitative reason. Every company has to have a competitive advantage that is sustainable, and obviously the more the better, but at least one. And then we want to make sure, again, it's a balanced portfolio. we always say that we're benchmark aware, but it doesn't rule our lives. We certainly don't build the portfolio together like, you know, being really precious about geographic locations. Now, I think of it this way, like we're never going to do anything that's really, I think, call it outsized, meaning use an example like Japan. Okay, Japan is something like 6% of our benchmark, all right,
okay.
Think of our global benchmark. Now, if we felt that there was tremendous opportunities in Japan, right, from just an investing standpoint or valuations, however you want to define it, you know, we might put 12% of the fund, maybe 15% at most in Japan. Okay, you're not going to wake up one day and have like 30% of the fund in Japan because, again, we just think that that's just taking too big a risk, certainly relative to, you know, ultimately, you know, what we're judged against. And more importantly, we just think that the world's just too fluid. It's too, you know, dynamic. And to make some sort of overarching, to call it a geographic call, would just be, I think, imprudent. Okay. So we make sure that it's balanced for geographically. The benchmarks, we're aware of it. It doesn't rule our lives. Same from a sector standpoint. Again, you're not going to wake up one day and have, you know, 50% of the fund in healthcare when our benchmark's at 13 or 14%. Okay. But we're happy to take, you know, a 20% position in healthcare.
Sure.
And have that active share sort of always hovering. It's always sort of historically been around 80% or so. So we certainly do have opinions on things. And position the portfolio accordingly. But how does it all work? Okay, we put it together. And what really is important to us when we look at the overall portfolio, we're looking at, okay, what is this, you know, whether we have a 10% Japan or a 6% Japan or a 3% Japan, or we have, you know, 14% in healthcare or 20% in healthcare. When it all comes together, what does the portfolio actually look like? What are the characteristics of this portfolio? Is it really high quality? Okay, does the underlying weighted average in the names of the portfolio reflect a really high quality portfolio? Is it reasonably valued? Right, we're not losing sleep at night if the market's trading at 17 times earnings and we're at 20 times earnings. That's okay. Is the dividend yield again? It's not the be all and end all, but we want to make sure that it is maintained above its benchmark. And,
right.
And typically, it's been pretty tight over the last several years, just because we found that's been where the best opportunities are. And call it, you know, not necessarily high yielding pure yield companies. It's been more call it dividend growth that we've been leaning towards, and that's what's allowed the fund to do reasonably well in what's been, like I said, a not great environment for pure dividend investing. And so, you know, you take all that together, and we make sure that we're reasonably exposed. We're not taking any massive call it bets on one particular sector or a particular geography. But what's key is that when we whittle it all down, this is still a really, really high quality portfolio. That, again, much higher margins, much higher return on capital than the benchmark. Reasonable growth. Typically, it's growing a little bit faster than the market, but again, it's not a growth, pure growth portfolio. And of course, that dividend yield, which is above benchmark, but again, not making any big, you know, huge calls in terms of whether it's going to be a yielding portfolio or a growth portfolio.
Right.
But some, you know, it's typically been right down the middle, and that's worked out pretty well. So.
Great context, Darren. We referenced at the beginning of the conversation the topic of a dream team and how you use the dream team. I almost think of it as a curated universe for you that have been selected because they hit one of those six moats that we talked about. Maybe talk to me a little bit about the importance of the dream team, as well as bring it into context today. We're recording in February 2024, and what are you seeing on your dream team? Have things changed, or are there areas that are emerging?
You hit it right on the head there, Matt. Like we're that's really our universe. That's what we spend our time on. That's what we, you know, when we're doing research, when we're traveling, when we're meeting with companies, it's what does this company deserve to be on the dream team? And I'll give you, you know, there's always been a few changes here. You know, I would say, you know, and the changes are often directed when we're looking at companies, we're looking at potential investments, and we're doing a competitive analysis. You know, and usually what happens is it reveals that, okay, this is a company that might have been on the dream team for many years, and realizing, you know what, it's kind of, I call it lost its way, but it's certainly the reason we bought the company or put it on the dream team years ago has changed. And a good example of this is when we first started looking and purchased a company called TSMC, or Taiwan Semiconductor. This is almost 6 years ago now. And of course, you know, what was on the dream team was Intel, right?
Right, sure.
And as we did more and more work on TSMC and did the analysis in terms of analyzing their process technology and their roadmap and you know, and then comparing it to Intel, we realized that, you know, Intel not only, you know, had fallen behind, you know, TSMC, and it really came down to, I think going back even further, like when the iPhone was released in 2007, Intel made a conscious decision to basically not really spend, like Apple went to them first, right? And said, look, we're building this smartphone and we obviously need, a semiconductor,
sure,
a chip manufacturer to help us with this. And Intel more or less said pass. And that's where TSMC had that opportunity. So, I mean, that's 2007, right? So now we bought it, you know, 2017, 2018, but Intel was on the Dream Team all that time. And it wasn't until we did the work on TSMC, we realized that Intel, you know, just didn't have the wherewithal to stick with TSMC. And so we said, look, under what circumstances would we ever own Intel? And given sort of its competitive position, it just, at this stage, we realized we couldn't justify it. And as it turns out, this is just, I actually checked this not too long ago, just out of coincidence, Intel's market cap was $200 billion in 2000. It's $180 billion today. So think about 24 years, the market cap's gone down. I think you've made some money on dividends maybe, but sure, that's about it, right?
Yeah.
So that's a good example. I'll tell you a company that was off the Dream Team and has come back on recently. Okay. You know, we've owned a competitor for many years, and we own, this is a company that we certainly would consider repurchasing, but GE, okay? We always view GE as having a jewel of a business in terms of being, you know, an aircraft jet engine manufacturer. We own Safran. We've owned Safran for as long as we've been running the fund, over 10 years now. And of course, we love the business. It's a classic razor blade business. The jet engine is 80% of the value of any airplane. It's a, you know, once you get the installed base, you know, you've got mandated, call it maintenance, part replacements. It's just a wonderful business. Now GE had, again, it's got a JV with Safran, so obviously they participated in that, but it had all this other stuff that was problematic, right? From its capital, its insurance business, its finance business, its transportation business, a bunch of stuff. It had an oil and gas arm that was in an energy arm that was really, call it, poorly run, or certainly, you know, disadvantaged from certain areas. So anyway, GE was a business that we'd followed obviously through having owned Safran, but we had taken it off the Dream Team a number of years ago, just based on all the other stuff that we just couldn't get our head around.
Right.
And over the past year or so, it's streamlined. It's now back to being almost a pure aerospace business, and ergo, it's back on the Dream Team. Right. And so that's a good example. Two examples, I think, of companies that, you know, one that had come off and one that's gone back on. And we always want to be pretty pragmatic about this stuff. And you know, it would be silly of us to say, okay, we're never going to look at GE again once it comes off the Dream Team. No, we monitor it. We keep an eye on it. We don't, you know, we're not modeling out these businesses every quarter,
sure,
you know, that aren't in the Dream Team, but we certainly are aware of it and keep an eye on things. And ultimately it progressed to the point where, you know, it's back to where we think that it deserves to be on the team. We have a price in mind. We have different mandates, like a US mandate where we actually own GE. That's a good example of a company that, you know, we taken off and then put back on, and in fact repurchased again fairly recently.
Darren, great examples. Really appreciate you spending the time. I certainly have a better feel for the overall portfolio, and I'll thank you for continuing to manage the funds and the success that you've achieved. So thanks, Darren. Appreciate you spending the time with me.
Happy to do it, Matt. Appreciate the offer and the time as well.
The content of this podcast, including facts, views, opinions, and recommendations, is not to be used or construed as investment advice and is not an offer or an invitation to buy or sell any security. The content of this podcast should not be relied upon for any purposes, and Mackenzie Financial Corporation is not responsible for any reliance upon it. This podcast includes forward-looking information that reflects our current expectations or forecasts of future events.
Forward-looking information is subject to risks, uncertainties, and assumptions that could cause actual results to differ materially from those expressed herein. Our views are subject to change based on market conditions. Commissions, trailing commissions, management fees, and expenses may be associated with mutual fund investments. Please read the fund facts and prospectus before investing. The indicated rates of returns are historical annual compounded total returns, including changes to unit values and reinvestment of all dividends or distributions, and does not take into account sales, redemptions, distribution, or optional charges or income taxes payable by any security holder that would have reduced returns.